Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Dueling deficit plans this week, dueling visions, a sad mom and kids in the river, and dismay over gas prices and more sleeping air traffic controllers. President Obama laid out his vision on deficit and taxes and went after the Republicans' plan.
I don't think there's anything courageous about asking for sacrifice from those who can least afford it and don't have any clout on Capitol Hill.
Republican Paul Ryan, chair of the House Budget Committee, hit back, slamming the president's appeal.
Excessively partisan, dramatically inaccurate, and hopelessly inadequate to addressing our country's pressing fiscal challenges.
And outrage and a top official out over air traffic controllers asleep in the tower. Here's Sacramento Air Traffic Control talking with a medical evacuation flight that couldn't raise Reno.
Okay, we're going to call them on the phone line.
All right, we'll circle more. We've got a pretty sick case when they just have to land.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Jake Tapper of ABC News, Nancy Cordes of CBS, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Are we getting real on deficits and national commitments or not? Are you watching Libya, Pakistan, the air traffic control tower? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Nancy Cordes is congressional correspondent for CBS News. She joins us from Washington today. Nancy, it's great to have you here.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Jake Tapper is ABC's senior White House correspondent with a big eye on the Capitol and beyond. Jake, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
Jack, great to have you here as well.
Pleasure to be here, Tom.
Let's check in at both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue just to start. Jake Tapper, how is the White House sizing up the big back and forth in the deficit debate? From the White House point of view, how's that gone this week, Jake?
I think they're happy with this debate. I think they're happy with the choices and the differences between the budget idea, the budget outline, debt reduction plan that President Obama has laid out in broad strokes. And the one that Republicans have offered through Congressman Paul Ryan of Wisconsin. The idea that there are two big fault lines, one that the president wants to let the Bush tax cuts for upper-income Americans expire and have that $1 trillion or so go to debt reduction versus the Ryan approach of changing Medicaid into a block grant system for the states, and changing Medicare to one, a system where basically seniors, instead of having the Medicare system working for them, would get money to then buy private insurance. This is a debate they want to have, and so I think they feel good about it.
And Nancy, what about at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue in Congress? Let's take the Republicans first. How do they feel about this? They got the biggest one-year tax cut in history a week ago. And now we see Paul Ryan's plan on the table, and we see the president's plan on the table. How do you see Republicans in terms of unity, in terms of their assessing how this is going for their goals?
Well, I think conservative Republicans and Tea Party Republicans are thrilled with Paul Ryan's plan. They think that it's bold. They think that it tackles the nation's fiscal challenges head on, and that it's realistic about how big changes need to be in order to get the debt and the deficit under control. I think moderate Republicans in swing districts, are a little bit more nervous. Nobody likes to campaign on wanting to overhaul Medicare in such a way that seniors lose benefits. If you recall, in 2010, that was a big Republican rallying cry against Democrats, and Democrats will have a lot of ammunition. So I think in this vote, you have moderate Republicans, even the Speaker of the House, not wholeheartedly endorsing Paul Ryan's plan, saying this week, I think it's a good option, which is not exactly what you're used to hearing from the Speaker when he's talking about his own party's plan.
Let's listen to President Obama for just a moment at his big speech at George Washington University on Wednesday, saying that getting the deficit under control is a top priority, part of his vision for the country.
This is our vision for America. This is my vision for America. A vision where we live within our means while still investing in our future. Where everyone makes sacrifices, but no one bears all the burden. Where we provide a basic measure of security for our citizens, and we provide rising opportunity for our children.
The Obama White House happy with the way the week rolled out. Republicans not so happy, particularly with the president's plan. Here's Republican Senator John Thune, South Dakota, talking with Bill Hemmer on Fox News yesterday, criticizing President Obama's speech.
To the degree that he presented any kind of a plan for the future, it involved raising taxes on our job creators, on our small businesses. So it's kind of the same old rhetoric, heavy on partisanship, very light on substance. And so we'll wait and see when the president actually submits a plan. This was the so-called vision. When he talks about a balanced vision, we all know what that means. That means that there are going to be tax increases on the American people.
Jack Beatty, what do you see unfolding in the dynamics around deficit fighting, the budget, spending, the sort of American agenda in this week?
Well, I think the president had to make the speech he did to essentially buoy his own party. He had, just in the last month, polls show he had lost something like 7% of support in his own party. He was down to 73% of Democrats. And opinion leaders were turning on him rapidly, Paul Krugman notably. Headlines from a week ago, liberals restive over deal. Now he makes a speech in which he states the Democratic faith and comes out strongly for protecting Medicare and Medicaid, comes out strongly against the politics of inequality as he sees it in the Republican deal. And what do we have from liberals? The New York Times, the man we elected the president has finally reemerged. So he is uniting his own party behind him. And I think that's the beginning of it. The second thing is he has really, to pick up on what Jake says, defined, or the Republicans have helped him to define the territory that they want to fight the 2012 election on, which is the Republicans want to cut grandma's Medicare to give tax cuts to billionaires and millionaires. That's the line they want to cut. If Paul Ryan hadn't cut taxes, if that hadn't been such an integral part of his deal, they wouldn't have left that opening. Wouldn't be there. That opening is there, and the president even reduced it to $6,000 from 33,000, whatever it was. I don't know how from 33 seniors to go to pay for tax cuts to one millionaire. We'll hear variants of that arithmetic from now through 2012, and if Republican presidential candidates endorse it. And the president hinted, he said, and now we seem Republican presidential candidates seem to be endorsing it. If they do, that's a very favorable field for the Democrats.
And yet, Jake Tapper, there are a lot of ways of looking at this calculus. Karl Rove, writing this week in The Wall Street Journal, the GOP will benefit from the budget debate. What's the GOP take on how this might roll out in their favor, Jake?
Well, I think, first of all, I would be surprised if Karl Rove or anybody like him wrote an op-ed that did not
say anything else. Yeah, fair enough.
That this would help their party, but and the same true for the Karl Roves of the Democratic Party. But I think that they feel that the Ryan plan is a more serious proposal than the president's plan, and I think that they feel that tax cuts are never. I mean, tax increases or whatever you want to call it, letting the Bush lower tax rates expire at the end of 2012.
Yeah.
For the sake of shorthand, I'll call them tax increases.
Mm-hmm.
That's a loser for Democrats. Even though higher taxes for upper income Americans tends to poll very well with the vast majority of Americans who are not upper income Americans, I think they also feel that there is, the country is more serious about the debt and deficit now than it has been in the past, and that some polls indicate that's true. Others differ, but that's their basic calculus on this: is that President Obama has done a huge spending binge with the stimulus and the health care bill and other provisions. And look, it's always easier to run as the person making promises than as the person with a record. And the Republican base right now is very fired up about the debt, about the deficit, and that's why we're about to have this really heated debate about whether or not Congress should raise the debt ceiling in May or June. And that's really going to be, potentially, could be a very, very ugly debate that really has many more ramifications than the kind of things Nancy and I were covering when we were covering potential government shutdown.
Nancy, I mean, 59 Republicans wouldn't even vote for the big $38 billion cut that President Obama and John Boehner agreed on last Friday. And in that vote this week, a lot of those Tea Party Republicans sitting on their hands. What does that foretell about the debt ceiling debate to come, Nancy?
Well, the kind of ironic thing, Tom, is that a lot of these members who voted no were the very members who were pushing John Boehner to have this fight in the first place. He had the fight. He got the $38 billion.
But they wanted more.
They turned around and voted no. They wanted more. They said it wasn't enough.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see that they're really digging in their heels for the next fight. And I think that what Republicans have learned from this last clash that they're going to be taking into the next debate is ask for everything. Ask for the world. You know, originally the Republican leaders came up with a figure. Okay, we are going to ask for $31 billion in cuts. And then the Tea Party said, that's not enough. Mm-hmm. You've got to double that. So they doubled it to 61. And lo and behold, where did they end up? But $38 billion. So that was a great negotiating strategy for them. And I think that you see Democrats now borrowing that strategy and saying, okay, we've got to start out with the strongest position possible. You know, you see it just on tax cuts alone. Republicans saying, rather audaciously, we want a 10-point cut for the wealthiest Americans. We want to go down from a 35% tax rate to a 25% tax rate. Then you've got the president on the other side saying, I absolutely will not reauthorize the Bush tax cuts. So I think everyone is realizing, okay, I've got to start out with my heels dug in, and then if I move to the middle, maybe that's where I wanted to be all along.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Deficit cards on the table, NATO, tension over Libya, outrage over more sleeping air traffic controllers, and that poor mom drives a car into the river and drowns three children. Nancy Cordes joins us from CBS News in Washington today. Jake Tapper, senior White House correspondent for ABC News. Jack Beatty's here. $38 billion plus in cuts this year, we're told, though much smaller numbers coming out from the Congressional Budget Office. We'll look at those. Different kinds of reactions. Some Republicans saying pretty good. Here's Republican Congressman Blake Farenthold of Texas expressing his satisfaction with the $38 billion cuts.
I agree there weren't enough cuts, but you've got to realize that we are only a part of the government, and we have got to compromise to go on. I think this is a historic win. We need to claim our win and move on.
We've got to compromise to go on. We'll see just how strong that view of the world is. Here's a Democrat not happy with those cuts, Democrat Jim McGovern of Massachusetts, arguing against that budget resolution on the House floor yesterday.
This bill cuts the wrong things too deeply and ignores some of the things that could stand to be cut. The cuts target the poor and the middle class, the very people who can least afford it as we struggle to recover from the Great Recession.
Nancy Cordes, Jake Tapper. Jack, stand by. Here's Janet calling from Auburn, Alabama. Janet, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Very, very thankful for this program every day. I avoided a shopping trip so that I could listen and got through. But listen, very much in support of the Obama plan. I feel that when conservatives talk about sharing the burden of getting our financial home and board within bounds and back in order, that they do it on the backs of the poor, the middle class. They are opposed to tax cuts, which, of course, I'm very in favor of, and thankful for the fact that Obama proposes deductions remaining for charity and home mortgages for the middle class. Just very much excited about what he has proposed. And as far as the possible Republican candidates for president, I find them both hysterically funny and scary. And again, thank you very much for your program.
Janet, I appreciate your call. We'll look at those Republican candidates, Romney, Santorum, putting up their hands a bit this week. One more call. Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Tom, you know, I think Obama's vision does not at all address what is really the problem or what is a fundamental problem, and that problem is Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And I've been hearing how politicians are afraid to touch these third rails for decades. Now, the CBO in June 2008 said that 30% of medical care dollars were wasted for unnecessary treatments. So So the real problem is we really cannot afford to pay the kind of treatments that the elderly are getting, especially when they're unnecessary.
So
no one's talking about that.
The question, can we really afford what President Obama says he will not back off of? Jake Tapper, Paul Ryan, whatever you may think of his plan, he definitely came up and touched that rail on Medicare here. I mean, he's taking away the guarantee. He's offering a voucher, a kind of coupon instead. How do you read that, Jack? Is that what it's actually going to take to get the deficit under control, Jake? Or is it the Democrats say that's an ideological decision on Paul Ryan's part to shrink government, get it out of people's lives?
Right. And the Obama administration has put forward, President Obama himself, this argument that it would cost the way that Paul Ryan's plan would change Medicare, which it would, without question, would mean about $6,400 more out-of-pocket expenses for seniors based on premiums and out-of-pocket expenses for visits to doctors.
Yep, yep.
This is the issue that anytime anybody on the Democratic or Republican side tries to discuss, they get attacked, whether it's death panels from the right or death. Nancy, help me out here. Debbie Wasserman Schultz just used a term.
I don't know what the opposite of death panels
is. It had the word death in it.
Something
deathly. I know there was the word
something
death
deadly.
There.
All right.
The word death was in it. And the point is this. According to experts, according to people who look at this sort of thing, an unbelievably large proportion of our health care dollar is spent on the last 6 months of a person's life. I think it's 25% of the healthcare dollar. You go to the last 2 years, and it goes up to 50%, something like that. And the question is, are those dollars being spent the best way? Are those individuals having a better life? Are they more comfortable? Is end of life care what it should be? Not just because it's so expensive, but because we have all this medical technology, and we're spending it all to keep people alive for another week or another month or another 3 months when the quality of their life might not be as good as if we did something else. And any time any politician tries to discuss this, they get attacked as trying to kill off old people, not wanting to let people have that extra test, that extra treatment, that extra procedure. And this is, I think, what the caller was talking about, and it's true. The New Yorker has done some fantastic writing on this, we are not at the point in our public debate where this conversation can be held without somebody being accused of trying to march Granny off to a death camp.
Of course, Jack.
And
Nancy, please.
It was death trap.
That's
what she called it.
Death panel, death trap. Of course, Jack. End of life is one thing, but there's a lot of seniors out there, or people imagining themselves out there one day, not at the end of life, at age 72, hoping to live to 92. Wanting a knee that'll let them walk around. And do that, Jack.
Yes, and when they start to figure out how much more the Ryan plan would cost them than current Medicare or than Medicare as modulated by the Obama fix, whatever that'll turn out to be, that may be help to turn the 22-point GOP advantage with seniors in 2010. That may help to turn it to the Democrats' advantage. There is a reason this is called the third rail, because it gets right down to what people think they're entitled to and what they can afford. Charlie Cook is an unsentimental person when he comes to electioneering.
The pollster.
Yes, he called the Democrats' health care bill a disaster right from the start. He said, this won't gain you votes. This will alienate independent voters. You can't run on it. It's a loser. Talk about the economy. People dismissed it through 2009. He was proven correct. Now he is saying, the same man with that credibility, the Republican Medicare and Medicaid cuts, but certainly the Medicare ones, are a potential death wish for the GOP. It's that serious, according to Charlie Cook.
On the other hand, you've got a lot of people saying the overall deficit is a kind of death wish for the country if we don't get our hands around it. Let's go to Grant, calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Grant, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Jack. Thanks for your time. Let's talk about the president's speech. I mean, we have the Ryan plan, which he's a Republican. He's put together a very sort of market-esque Republican plan. There's a progressive plan floating out there, and we'll engage in debate and kind of come up with something that hopefully, like Reagan and Tip O'Neill did, you know, splits the difference and makes this work. But the president's speech, he seems to spend a lot of energy demagoguing, you know, the starve grandma approach, you know, Republicans are evil here, and it seemed to really, he missed a chance to lead here, to really say, to take Ryan's, what he did, stick his neck out here, and say, yes, well, we can work together. Mm-hmm. He used an excuse more to campaign.
Nancy, let us pick that up. And Grant, thanks for your call. I mean, he did go hard at, very hard at the Republicans, at Paul Ryan's plan, and then in the same speech, and this week, saying, you know, ah, but we'll sit down and we'll work something out before this, borrowing deadline, deficit ceiling deadline in June. How do you square that circle? How do you go so hard at it? It may be politically advantageous. But then deal with the reality that the Republicans do have a significant fire in the belly and votes on Capitol Hill.
Well, I think there were two reasons that he did that. First of all, Republicans have very publicly over the past several weeks been coming out, their leadership has, saying the president isn't leading. He's not a leader. And I think he wanted to hit back at them for that. And then I think that Paul Ryan got a lot of attention for his plan. And there were a lot of people writing that it was very courageous and, you know, how much courage
stepping
he
up.
Had to, yep. to put this out. And I think the president was really trying to reclaim the mantle of leader and say, not only do I not agree with that plan, I don't think it's courageous. I think it's the wrong approach for our country. And of course, what made it sting all the more was that he had Paul Ryan and several other Republican leaders sitting right there in the front row. He had invited them. Yeah. I don't think that they expected him to hit out as hard as he did at them.
Right. Try eating this for supper, Congressman Ryan. Kirby in Lexington, Kentucky. You're on the air, Kirby.
Thank you. First of all, I want to agree with the other caller that cited the excessive use of near end-of-life care. Both my parents faced those kinds of issues. My mother refused absolutely heroic efforts and probably foolhardy efforts that might have extended her life very briefly. My father, who had Alzheimer's, did not have the option to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister was in a terrible bind about some decisions that she made. And he had extensive surgery and lived another 2 weeks. I think we're going to have to face also the issue of rationing care as we realize very expensive and new innovative treatments, everybody's not going to be able to afford those. We're going to need a two-tier system that guarantees everybody a basic level of care, which we don't have now, and which I think was some effort of the Obama general health care plan. Mm. We're going to have to face that there are going to be other kinds of procedures that everybody's not going to be entitled to.
Does that put you in the Ryan camp then, Kirby, or in the Obama camp?
Absolutely not. I think the Ryan camp is nuts. I think that the issue of facing what we need to do at end-of-life care and recognizing some of these extraordinarily innovative procedures are not going to be available to everybody.
But that's pretty hard. That's a hard thing to sell. I mean, there's your third rail again. I know exactly what you mean, Kirby. That cost is right there, but how to deal with it. I mean, the president was back out on the campaign trail for the first time. First sort of campaign season formal speech in Chicago. And what does he go for? He goes straight at his health care reform and how he says, you know, it will help save people.
Because of you, we did what we've been trying to do for almost a century, and we made sure that everybody in this society of ours, if you get sick, you don't have to go bankrupt. If you get sick, you don't have to mortgage your house. If your child has a pre-existing condition, they're still going to be cared for because we passed health care reform that provided coverage to 30 million Americans.
And the crowd cheers in Chicago. But I guess one question here, Jake, is whether or not we're actually getting closer to real deficit reduction. There was so much ballyhoo about the $38 billion in cuts just in the last half of this year. But then we've got this Congressional Budget Office report that says it's really only $350 million in actual cuts. That's hard to even understand, Jake. Just this year.
Speaker Boehner strongly disputes that. And one of the ways he does this, and I'm sure Nancy's much more of an expert on this than I am, since she's a congressional correspondent. But one of the ways he does this is by saying what the budget deal does is limit how much the president can spend, and what the Congressional Budget Office is analyzing is how much is actually in the pipeline as opposed to what the potential is for the president to spend in parts of the budget, such as emergency spending. So there is a strong pushback from Speaker Boehner's office on that. But if I could just get to one of the issues that the caller addressed in terms of rationing care, which is, of course, another one of these healthcare boogeymen. Mm-hmm. We already ration care in this country. We do it all the time as a society. The difference is that right now health insurance companies are the ones rationing care, deciding who can get care, who is uninsurable, who can get what treatment. So that is already the status quo. The American people have rationed care right now. Those decisions are made by companies with a bottom line that are trying to make money. The debate is whether or not some of the decisions about what is best for healthcare treatment should be taken away from those insurance companies in some instances and made by independent boards made of doctors and healthcare experts. That's the death panel that Sarah Palin referred to, and erroneously, I should say.
I take your point there exactly, Jake. That's right on the edge of what's being gone back and forth on here. But Nancy, take us back to that $38 billion and the $350 million. It's hard for people to
understand. I just lost all sound.
Nancy, can you explain?
Can
you explain those numbers for us?
Absolutely. So I had a long talk with the Congressional Budget Office yesterday because when these numbers came out from the CBO that the $38 billion budget deal would only cut about $350 million this year, a lot of people freaked out and they said, wait a minute, what does this deal really mean? So what the CBO is saying is that just this year, you will see a savings or a reduction in the deficit of $350 million. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but think of it this way. Think of it as your family is having a tough budget conversation and you're coming up with a more austere family budget.
Yeah.
Well, if you look at your bank account next week and go, well, how much did we save after that conversation? The answer is going to be not much.
But I still don't get it, Nancy, because
in a year or two.
But I thought this was to fund the government for the last half or less of the fiscal year.
Right.
I thought this was for 6 months. I don't see how you get down from $38 billion to only $350 million.
Well, you save over the course of 5 years, you save $20 to $25 billion because the money is authorized this year, but it gets spent over several years.
Okay.
So the money we're spending right now actually got authorized several years ago. So in the immediate short term, you save $350 million this year. But over the course of the next 4 or 5 years, as all that money that was authorized gets spent, you save $20 to $25 billion.
Where does the $38 billion come in? Or is that just a mirage?
Well, the $38 billion comes from the fact that they made a lot of cuts to things that, while the money was never going to be spent anyway. For example, with the census, $7 billion was authorized to conduct the 2010 census. Well, they didn't spend about $2 billion of those $7 billion. So in this budget deal, this is where that fancy accounting you've heard of comes in.
Yep.
They basically agreed to take that $2 billion back. Well, that technically counts as cuts. It's cuts in budget authority. But was that money actually going to get spent? No. So that's why the CBO crunched the numbers and said, okay, of that $38 billion that you cut, we're really only going to see about $20 to $25 billion in savings.
You know, Jake Tapper, there's going to be a lot of people who have a kind of show-me mentality here when these kind of numbers come out. You know, $38 billion, no, $350 million, no, maybe someday $22 billion. The deficit is trillions and trillions. You can hear the skepticism out there as people watch.
No, absolutely, and the skepticism is appropriate. The problem is, according to polling, is that the American people, and this is the fault of politicians, it's the fault of the media, even though, Tom, I know you have had serious discussions, I know Nancy's done serious pieces on it, I've done serious pieces on it, but the American people do not understand what needs to change in order for the deficit to be really reduced.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, gas prices soaring. Drivers from Los Angeles to Connecticut felt the pain.
I just put in $13, and it got me about 3 gallons.
$4.11.
It alters everything.
New York mom LaShonda Armstrong drove a minivan into the Hudson River, drowning herself and three of her children. Her aunt tried to square that sad circle.
She was a good mother. Just because she drove a car, she was a good mother. She was going through some stuff. She was going through some stuff, okay?
Good mother. And a ban on Islamic face veils went into effect in France, spawning protests. Here's one woman defending her right to wear the niqab, the veil.
Whether a woman is wearing a niqab or a miniskirt or feathers on her back, it's really about individual liberty. No one has the right to dictate to others how they should dress, walk, or think. It's my choice and it's my religion.
We're looking at a week in the news this hour. Deficit cards on the table, NATO tension over Libya. We'll hear on that front outrage over more sleeping air traffic controllers. Nancy Cordes of CBS News is with us, congressional correspondent there. Senior White House correspondent for ABC News, Jake Tapper, is with us, and Jack Beatty. Jake, we've got plenty of callers here, but I missed your you were getting to your big point on Americans, what the insight that's going to be coming down the road here on deficits, I guess.
Well, the money is in the Pentagon budget, Medicare and Medicaid, and the interest on the debt, the interest payments on the debt. If we continue spending money and borrowing money at the rate we're going, within, I think, 7 years, the interest payment on the debt will be larger than what we're spending on Medicare, which is one of the biggest parts of our budget.
Yeah.
So this is why everybody's talking about it this year. It is approaching crisis proportions. Imagine, to put it in street terms, because I know you have a lot of ruffians that listen to your show. If you're if you owe money to a loan shark and you get hung up on the VIG, the interest, so much so that you can't even pay the original debt, eventually you're going to face some real problems. So the serious cuts that need to happen require that there be an education campaign by the media and by politicians. For instance, I think it's a majority of the public that believes that our foreign aid budget is something around 25%. It's actually closer to 1%. People think that waste, fraud, and abuse and foreign aid, eliminating that, will take care of the problem. And while there is tremendous Medicare and Medicaid waste, it's just not honest. There needs to be a serious discussion about what needs to be done. I'm not an advocate for what needs to be done one way or the other, but people need to understand the choices. And I don't think that we're hearing a full description of the choices yet. We're getting there. We're getting there, but we're not there yet.
Jake, let us get our listeners on just that front. Sherry is calling from Nashville. Hi, Sherry. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I do beg to differ in that I think that the American people do understand, and that I think that they know that what's on the plate, the big three things that are on the plate are entitlements and, of course, defense spending. And entitlements, I mean Medicare, Medicaid, and I also mean Social Security. And I think we all do have to make sacrifices, but the fact that I think one of your guests on the show said that the media isn't portraying it correctly. I think about 50% of the media is portraying it correctly. And we know that these small little bits and pieces with Planned Parenthood and NPR are just small little fish in the ocean compared to what really needs to be cut. And I really do think the American people do know what needs to be done, and we just need to keep fighting for it.
So are you prepared to go to look to the bigger fish then, Sherry? Are you ready to take that pain?
I'm ready to take a little bit of pain. You know, my husband and I, we're upper middle class people, and we made a little over $100,000 jointly together. So
okay.
We make about $50,000 a year.
Yeah.
And we want to pay our taxes. 30% of it, the government took. And if I was living in Norway or in Europe somewhere, my government would be taking about 40% of my taxes. But for that one little 10%, you know what I wouldn't have to worry about, Tom? Mm. I wouldn't have to worry about my children's education. I wouldn't have to worry about my retirement. And more importantly, I would not have to worry about my health care. To me, you know, we just don't have the perspective right on it. We don't get it here in America. We really need to figure out something different.
Sherry, I can hear the sound of pollsters listening very closely to what you're saying right there, as a sort of one sample of American opinion. I appreciate your call. Let me get one more right here. Omaha, Nebraska, and Patrick. Hi, Patrick, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, you know, the amazing thing is the amount of obfuscation that goes on regarding all these fake budget crises that we have. The whole thing is Friedman economics. It was done, you know, but the barrel of American guns down in the southern cone and everything else throughout the last 50 years, and they're trying to do the same stuff here.
What do you mean obfuscation? They're telling us we're spending 40 cents of every dollar on interest already. If that's true, that sounds like quite a number.
It is quite a number, and it's primarily for 200-plus military bases, over 50% of our budget going to empire that we can't sustain. People don't understand their history. They don't know their history. We're going down the same road as Rome, Great Britain, Spain, Portugal. Have your pick.
Patrick, I appreciate your call. You know, it's interesting, though. You're hearing more talk about that Pentagon budget now than I think that perhaps I have ever heard. I want to turn to Republican heads coming up toward 2012 here. Rick Santorum this week, getting into the exploratory committee business, and Mitt Romney, who was, of course, out last time and out again this time with his presidential exploratory committee. Here he is on CNBC's Kudlow Report on Tuesday, talking about the president's economic policies. Mitt Romney.
Right now, you've got a president focused on taxing people. The real issue is to say, how do you get people back to work? Mm. The American people I talk to don't spend every moment thinking, how can I tax my neighbor more than they're being taxed? They say, how can I get a good job? How can my kids get good jobs? How can seniors have confidence in their future when they know that Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid are bankrupt?
Jake Tapper, what do you see the White House thinking of the field of Republican contenders emerging to challenge President Obama?
It's tough to say right now because you never know what they actually think and what they're just spinning you on.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I think that they know and believe that it's going to be a very tight election. I think that we're going to see a focus on some states that President Obama won in 2008, and some, I would be very amazed if he put a lot of money into winning Indiana, for example. The president has told friends that, you know, he caught lightning in a bottle last time. This is going to be a much different election than 2008. I think that they are heartened every time somebody like Newt Gingrich or Mike Huckabee or Sarah Palin indulges some of the less tethered to reality theories about the president's origins in terms of his birth certificate or where he was raised. There is, according to a recent poll, I think it's about 37% of Republicans question whether the president was born in the United States. That's a number that makes Democrats happy and makes Republicans upset, because that means that there is going to be a race to Crazy Town in order to win some of those Republican votes of people who have so much antipathy for the president, they're not necessarily able to see straight. And the voters are focused on what Mitt Romney talked about, jobs and the economy, and not President Obama's birth certificate. And Mitt Romney, to his credit, has discounted this wacky conspiracy theory. And independents are focused on that. And independents overwhelmingly know the president was born in the United States. But I think every time you hear some of this less serious discussion in the Republican field, whether it's from Donald Trump or whomever, the Democrats and the White House feels better.
Jack, I think you've seen Mitt Romney on the stump recently. He's been up in your New Hampshire territory.
Yes, he has, and I watched him in Nevada last week on C-SPAN. He's a very much more effective candidate than I remember. He gave a speech to a group. He spoke without a teleprompter. He only occasionally looked at his notes. He evinced a kind of wit, and throughout he evinced a kind of a sort of practical man's condescension toward President Obama. He said, one way or another, President Obama does not know how to negotiate. He gives away, talking about foreign policy, he concedes too much and he gets back too little. Well, of course, that critique is the same one Paul Krugman makes about the president on the domestic side. He concedes too much. He doesn't know how to negotiate. He's not strong enough. So So he found an issue there, and heads were nodding, just as he described in Romney's version of the president's negotiating with the Russians, with Israel, wherever it was. So I thought it was very effective. On the other hand, you know, his announcement this week, or release of his video, mm-hmm. coincided with the fifth anniversary of passage of the health care law in Massachusetts. In another world, that would rank as one of his signal achievements. In fact, in the history of health care reform, he's a historic figure. But, of course, he can't boast of that in the GOP primary. And that issue, his identification with a version of, quote, Obamacare in Massachusetts, is going to do him nothing but harm in the Republican primaries.
Jack, Jake, Nancy, stand by. I want to go talking about a race to crazy town. All these sleeping air traffic controllers. I want to be sure to touch that. This week, another at Nevada's Reno Tahoe International Airport, asleep on the job Wednesday morning. 7 instances, I think, in total now. On CBS yesterday, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood discussed his frustration with safety issues, steps he's taken to improve on this front.
This is outrageous behavior. It's ridiculous, and that's the reason that I ordered 2 controllers in every tower from 12 midnight till 6 in the morning in 27 towers so that people have the assurance that these towers are safe mm-hmm. and the controllers can guide planes in and out of airports.
That seems to be the least we might expect. Let me get a call right there from Daytona Beach, Florida. Stephen, thanks for calling. You're on the air, Stephen.
Yes, I recall a few years ago the air traffic controllers threatened a strike with their union, PATCO. And as a result of that mentioned strike over working conditions, the president at the time, Ronald Reagan, decertified the union. Can you comment with your extensive resources and tell me who is actually representing the air traffic controller workforce as far as working conditions?
That is interesting. I don't know if we can cover that entirely here, but Nancy, please. Yeah, is this, you know, a decades later fallout from that breaking the air traffic controllers union back way back in the Reagan administration?
That's a complicated question. I mean, you've mm-hmm. got the NATCA, which is the Air Traffic Controllers Union, which represents the bulk of air traffic controllers. But, and this is what often causes a lot of confusion, often when you've got just one controller in a tower overnight, that is what's known as a supervising controller. And they are actually employees of the FAA, not represented by the union because they're management. So sometimes the problem lies with controllers represented by the union. Sometimes it lies with people who are employed by the FAA. And I think what is so confusing for people, look, I've spent a lot of time on the overnight shift myself. I know it's grueling.
Yes.
But, you know, if you're sitting there at the desk and the phone rings, normally that would wake you up. So what's so confusing to people is why, if these controllers did nod off when they were getting phone calls from controllers in other towers trying to reach them, trying to say, look, there's someone trying to land at your airport, why they were in such a deep sleep that even the phone didn't wake them up.
It's one thing to nod off over your story. That's bad, but to nod off when mm-hmm. you've got the passenger airliners in the air. I want to quickly mm-hmm. touch on Libya because we heard this interesting sound out of NATO this week saying, kind of, America, get back here, help us out. France and Britain have been looking to the U.S. for more leadership and support in those operations over Libya. Here's Etienne de Duran, the Director of Security Studies at the French Institute for International Relations, giving the European perspective.
The fact that the United States has pretty much withdrawn from the operation and has left Ethiopian allies alone has left the alliance without a clear leader. The French and the Brits would like to ramp up the sorties, the strikes, etc., to see those strikes increased. Whereas NATO as a whole, as an organization, is, let's say, more prudent.
Need the U.S. as a leader. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was in Berlin for a NATO meeting with foreign ministers yesterday. She said the U.S. is helping NATO work toward a shared goal in Libya.
We are sharing the same goal, which is to see the end of the Gaddafi regime in Libya, and we are contributing in many ways in order to see that goal realized.
Working toward the same goal, maybe, Jake Tapper, but do you see any sign of the United States responding to this European call for more American aircraft over Libya?
Not right now. The White House Press Secretary Jay Carney has said that activity will increase, but will also ebb and flow. I mean, one of the issues going on here is first of all, there are huge domestic political considerations when it comes to this, because obviously not just because the U.S. is involved in two wars, but because there's a movement in the Congress to declare that there is no vital national interest involved in the Libya deal. In fact, I think Senator John Cornyn from Texas introduced a resolution to that effect. So there is a push to stop or to at least pull back all the way. You heard it from the very beginning of the president talking about military involvement in Libya. There was, from the very beginning, this reinforcement of we're not going to have ground troops, our role is going to be limited, we're going to be, I think the word he used was enabling the Europeans to do this. The bigger issue at stake here is that we spend so much on our military for our allies. Our allies have been able to stop spending as much as they address their budget deficits, knowing that they can count on the United States. This is something that the Europeans don't like to talk about very much, or the South Koreans or whomever, but we are basically a protector for all of our allies. And that becomes a problem for the United States when Europeans are actually like, oh, we really need you to use your unique assets.
Jack, do you think Europe can walk away from this one? Could they? I mean, Libya's right over the water there. Refugees, trouble on their doorstep, all the rest.
Well, we've seen the word demobilization used, that if it looks like any sort of deal is going to be broached in Libya, the coalition will demobilize. The countries will go back to what they're doing. You know, this larger issue of NATO is so critical. We still have 80,000 troops in Europe, and yet most European nations are already spending far below the 2% of national income they're obliged to spend on the alliance. This, a day of reckoning is approaching, and I think Obama is already signaling that that day is soon, that NATO is going to have to pay more for its own defense.
Well, we're in hot territory here on many fronts. Nancy Cordes is going to be hot on Capitol Hill. Good luck, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Jake Tapper with ABC News. Thank you, Jake, for being here.
Anytime, Tom. Thank you.
And thank you, Jack Beatty. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.